Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. New evidence supplied by NASA scientists indicates an ozone hole could open right over the United States. Right now, damaging chemicals have been found in this latitude in higher concentrations than ever over Antarctica or the North Pole. Meanwhile, DuPont, major suppliers of CFCs, says it will change, but only if there is a new market for its products. Meanwhile, Conoco Oil, a subsidiary of DuPont, is supporting a Citizens Advisory Committee. Committee member Kay Blem says it sends a message.
Some of the other refineries in the area are watching this advisory committee very carefully. And if it proves to be a success for DuPont, I think that other companies will probably do something like it.
These stories this time on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. A dramatic ozone hole could open over the United States. NASA scientists announced recently that a dangerous buildup of damaging chlorofluorocarbons, also known as CFCs, could lead to an atmospheric breakdown in the Northern Hemisphere. Scientists are frightened. Environmentalists are outraged. DuPont, chief supplier of the chemical culprits, says they would eliminate production and use of the chemical if the market could adjust adequately to any substitute. Using both the Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite launched last September and a series of high-altitude flights in specially equipped airplanes, Harvard chemist Dr. James Anderson, leading a team of investigating scientists, says it all started with a couple of questions.
The first question was, will there be an ozone hole in the Northern Hemisphere sometime in the next decade or two decades? The second question was to understand the mechanism behind the broad geographic erosion of ozone that's been reported by satellite studies over the past 10 years.
British scientists were the first to observe the process happening over Antarctica. The 1985 discovery led to the development of an extensive global investigation to measure the extent and function of this phenomenon. For the most part, the investigation has centered over the polar caps, the breakdown of CFCs into chlorine monoxide. The enemy agent in this case most easily occurs in the super sub-zero atmosphere over those regions. Dr. Michael Curilo, director of NASA's upper-level research program, says the investigation, which began in Fairbanks, Alaska, turned up shocking results.
What we found as a result of 4 months of data from our six-month aircraft campaign is a buildup of the most reactive forms of chlorine, the culprits that are responsible for the Antarctic ozone hole. We've seen them now at levels which exceed any that had been observed previously by aircraft in either the Arctic or the Antarctic. The levels themselves are measured in a unit of parts per billion or parts per trillion, and what we're seeing is 1.5 parts per billion, which is about two orders of magnitude, 100 times greater than what their normal abundance would be in the atmosphere.
Caused by the rotation of the planet, the polar cap winds, referred to as a vortex, swirl in a circular motion, controlled in part by the amount of sunlight heat available. In the winter, in the Northern Hemisphere, with less sunlight and therefore less heat, the vortex normally swirls farther south. Flying out of Fairbanks directly into the vortex, Curilo says the scientists were astounded at what they found.
During our January deployment, it actually shifted such that its edge was very close to Bangor, Maine. Hence, during the actual flight range of the ER-2 aircraft that we used, we were able to cut across almost the entirety of the vortex, actually fly through its center, something that we had never done previously with this type of sampling. And that gave us a very quantitative appraisal of the degree of what we call chemical conversion, the degree to which this buildup of reactive chlorine had occurred within the vortex. And as a result of that flight, as well as previous flights during January, we were able to ascertain that virtually the entirety of the polar vortex had been conditioned to these extremely high levels of reactive chlorine. That, on that particular flight, there was a fair amount of amazement, I guess it would be, on the part of the scientists. I mean, certain exhilaration in terms of the significance of the findings, but also a very deep concern that, while from a science perspective, this was just incredibly interesting, from an environmental perspective, we knew that it was certainly most alarming.
Mission Director Dr. Anderson describes the present location of this vortex.
Well, its southern extremity corresponds to central northern Maine. Its width extends from eastern Greenland well over into the central western provinces of Canada, and its northern extent runs up well over the polar region.
For years, environmentalists have been interpreting the scientific data and speaking in increasingly alarming terms about the consequences. Speaking here as a scientist, Anderson adds a new note of deep concern, even as he calmly describes the causes of this new situation.
Well, the cause for its present position is that it's trapped between two high-pressure areas, one over the Aleutians and one over the North Atlantic. And this isn't an unusual circumstance. This vortex is known to come down to these latitudes. What is unusual and unprecedented is what it contains, and that is higher chlorine monoxide than we've seen any time in previous studies in the Antarctic or in the Arctic prior to this.
Allowing more ultraviolet radiation to reach ground level, the primary result of a breakdown of the protective ozone layer, will have three immediate public health consequences, says Alexandra Allen, an atmosphere specialist with Greenpeace in Washington.
Well, the first and best known is skin cancer, and several hundred thousand new cases of skin cancer are predicted to occur each year as a result of ozone depletion. The second major effect that people may not be at all as familiar with is suppression of the human immune system. This is a consequence of enormous magnitude because the immune system obviously is the body's defense against infectious disease. And if the ability of people to fight off infectious disease is impaired, we can be talking about a public health problem of quite an order of magnitude. The third major area of public health impacts is eye disease. The human eye is not accustomed to any level of ultraviolet radiation other than that which naturally occurs, and there is no adaptive ability, for example, to become accustomed to a different level. It's possible to obviously wear UV protective eyeglasses in situations where people have access to that kind of thing. There are a lot of countries where getting a hold of such a thing would not be such a simple matter. The United Nations Environment Program predicts that over 1.5 million new cases of cataracts will occur worldwide because of increased ultraviolet radiation.
Then, says Allen, there will be dramatic effects on the ecosystem.
Just in the same way that the human eye cannot adapt in any manner to this increased level of UV, plants also cannot adapt, can't wear sunscreen or hats or anything else, and are directly sensitive to these increases in ultraviolet radiation. It affects plants' ability to fight disease, carry out photosynthesis. It stunts their growth, alters root structures, and inhibits germination. I mean, that's a pretty wide range of effects, and all of those have been seen in experimentation with UV in plant life. Marine ecosystems are affected profoundly. Phytoplankton, ocean plankton, form the base of the marine food chain. This means that essentially all life in the ocean is dependent on these tiny little creatures that exist primarily in the upper parts of the ocean, right on the surface. And these organisms are destroyed by elevated levels of ultraviolet radiation. UV radiation damages their genetic material, interferes with photosynthesis, and eventually can kill these creatures. Scientists have already measured a reduction in the population of phytoplankton under the Antarctic ozone hole in the South Pole.
While it is recognized that a certain amount of chlorine is emitted into the atmosphere from natural sources, the volcano at Mount Pinatubo, for example, by far the greatest amount is man-made. Allen joins with others in calling for a halt to all production of CFCs, especially by the inventing corporation, DuPont.
So what could be done, clearly, is to stop producing these chemicals. This is imperative now to continue to produce more of these to add to the stockpiles and banks of these chemicals at a time when the ozone layer is deteriorating, you know, essentially out of control, much faster than scientists had ever predicted, and with consequences that, that range from, you know, human immune effects to cataracts to ecological damage. It's just incredibly foolhardy to keep producing these chemicals, and we think it's a corporate irresponsibility of the first magnitude for DuPont and other companies to keep making these chemicals. They need to get into the business of safe alternatives.
In fact, in 1987, most nations signed an agreement in Montreal, Canada, called the Montreal Protocol, designed to phase out production and use of CFCs. We asked Anthony Vogelsberg, environment manager for DuPont's fluorochemical division in Wilmington, Delaware, whether his corporation is prepared to comply.
Well, DuPont would clearly comply with any regulatory action, and if requested and told to phase out tomorrow, we would do so. If asked if that was prudent, we would suggest that society needs to make a determination whether or not they can afford to be without chlorofluorocarbons until there are suitable substitutes in their place.
Vogelsberg says DuPont is committed to phasing out CFC production no later than 1997, as required by the International Protocol. In light of the new evidence, would DuPont step up its phase-out schedule? Under certain conditions, says Vogelsberg.
We actually look at the science as confirming what we understood in the past year to be true. And what we sense is that the public is now getting a better understanding of the importance of a rapid phase-out. And so we would envision that this would put more pressure on the downstream industries that we sell to make a more rapid transition. So from that standpoint, we think that the added pressure is favorable. Will DuPont look at moving faster? As I said, our position has always been we will move as fast as possible, but will commit to a phase-out no later than January of 97. If our customers and society in general is willing to spend the money to move faster, we applaud that and we will support it and we will make an adjustment to our commitment accordingly.
Vogelsberg indicates it is up to us, the public, to call for these products, regardless of any international agreements. Dr. Anderson says it actually does not much matter how much we in the United States cut back. Neither China nor India, two of the world's largest users of CFCs as they compete to catch up to the industrialized West, did not sign the Montreal Protocol. They alone, says Anderson, produce enough chlorine to cripple any international agreement. Whatever we do, Dr. Anderson says, we haven't much time.
This problem has been emerging in greater and greater severity for some time, and I've been studying this problem and associated problems for over 20 years, and two decades ago, I believed we had a long-term serious problem on the timescale of a century. 5 years ago, I felt we had a problem on the timescale of a quarter of a century. I now believe we have a serious problem on the timescale of 5 years.
The recent high-altitude study will be continued in March to determine whether the drifting vortex has moved, and if so, where, and whether the air mass has begun to stabilize and heal. We'll let you know. This is Bruce Robertson. It's a common story, citizens pitted against industry in a struggle for cleaner air and water. One corporation is taking a different approach, involving local citizens in the process early on, in an attempt to catch the problems before they occur. The DuPont Corporation has been identified as one of the largest polluters in the nation, but there are signs of change. Conoco Oil, a DuPont subsidiary, is organizing a citizens' advisory council in an effort to clean up its act. Bob Rehau visited one in Billings, Montana.
The Billings Refinery Conoco Citizens Advisory Council was formed in November of 1990. It's the first Citizens Advisory Council set up by Conoco nationwide. The councils are part of 9 environmental initiatives established by Conoco President Constantine Nikandros in April of 1990.
I think in some instances it's been a learning process for Conoco DuPont itself. We sit around that table and we ask some tough questions.
Councilmember Kay Blem represents the Yellowstone Valley Citizens Council.
The Friends of the Earth has put out a publication called Hold the Applause, which is a study on DuPont. And in that study, it says that DuPont is the largest polluter in the nation. Their new CEO wants to overcome that, I believe.
Blem and the 13 other council members represent sectors of the community ranging from agriculture to education. They meet the first Monday of each month for about 2 hours. The council has defined its purpose to be a conduit between the Billings community and Conoco. To accomplish this goal, council members have made presentations to various groups throughout the community. However, much of the council's early work has focused on learning about environmental issues, such as air and water quality and hazardous waste. Council member Joe Floyd.
I think most of us are beginning to realize that part of the key to all of this is education, educating the public about these issues. But these issues are complex, and the education of the public about them is not easy. It's difficult. You can't simplify some of this stuff, and it takes, we've spent hours listening to this and studying it, and it is confusing.
What about the trying to solicit from them their concerns or questions that didn't...
Agnes, I'd like to comment. Agnes got up and she really solicited the audience.
Council member Jose Chavez has been a Conoco employee for nearly 25 years. He says the formation of programs like the Advisory Council reflect the company's effort to improve long-term planning.
Instead of having a water problem that results from, say, 15, 20 years ago from dumping hazardous waste into a hole, we're doing things that are required of us now. And I've seen that happen, and it is good business to clean up your act or to do things that are going to be beneficial to the community, not only in the PR attitude, but just business per se.
Fellow council member Kay Blem agrees. She says Conoco's actions have caught the attention of their competitors.
Some of the other refineries in the area are watching this advisory committee very carefully. And if it proves to be a success for DuPont, I think that other companies will probably do something like it.
Council members believe Conoco is sincere in its effort to improve its environmental record. In forming the Advisory Council program, Conoco President and Chief Executive Officer Constantine Nicandro said, the councils will help identify and implement environmental plans and activities. According to Nicandro, these community representatives will be able to watch and see if the company performs and blow the whistle if it does not. For the High Plains News Service, I'm Bob Reha.
The High Plains News Service is a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils in Billings, Montana. If you have ever tried to boil an uncovered liquid in your microwave, you probably ended up with a mess all over the inside of the oven. Terry White, a researcher at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee, has been working on this problem, except he is applying his knowledge not to food, but to radioactive waste.
We can't afford to make splatters and messes when we do this. We want to have a nice, clean process. So we have to have a way to monitor the amount of boiling in the slurry. And depending upon the amount of boiling, we need to raise or lower the power to compensate for upsets that you might get. So we devised a scheme to feed back a signal that measures the amount of boiling, and if we get a lot of boiling, we reduce the microwave power automatically.
White improved on the process of using microwaves to solidify the liquid wastes by learning how to control the boiling process. By law, radioactive waste must be stored in a solid form, with no escaping gases or liquids. The idea of applying microwave heat to radioactive waste is relatively new. To begin the process, the liquid waste, or slurry, is mixed with sludge, which is a solid. Next, the microwave heat is applied, causing the molecules in the waste to vibrate, heating from within. This boils the liquid out of the mixture, leaving deposits of a hard, dry salt cake. In the past, this radioactive material had to be transferred from a cooking bin into its storage container. But White refined the process so it can be done, as he says, in drum.
We developed a unique applicator to microwave materials inside their metal containers. Now, the advantage of that is that it is the final storage container. So when you're finished filling it up, you can seal it and package it for disposal. And then you put a new container in and you start the process all over again. So there's no transfer of this hot material required. It's all done in the final container.
While White's improvements themselves are substantial, the microwave process in general has many advantages over the methods normally used to treat radioactive waste. For example, microwave heating requires less contact with the radioactive material.
When you compare the microwave process to a conventional heating process, there are several advantages that just pop right out. Conventional heating processes have to have heating elements either in direct contact or above the material to be heated. And these heating elements are subject to wear and corrosion, and they have to be maintained. Now, the problem with this would be is in a radioactive environment is that it requires people to suit up and undergo risks to replace this equipment, to maintain the equipment. The microwaves, on the other hand, heat the material directly. And the material is its own heating element with microwaves. And so there are no heating elements to replace or maintain.
The most common process used to dry out radioactive waste has several moving parts. Called a white film evaporator, the equipment includes a cylinder covered with the waste and blades, which spread the sludge around. Operators run into problems when the machine needs maintenance. Everything is radioactive, including any parts removed. By contrast, the microwave tube sends waves through a window, separating it from the contaminated area. At this point, White's research is in the test phase, using non-radioactive material in the drums. But researchers in Japan have been using microwaves on radioactive material for 5 or 6 years. Considering the lack of funding in the United States, White says he is not surprised to see more advanced research in Japan.
They're ahead of the world in this area, and it's an area that I think that, this country ought to be looking at, because these systems have a lot of advantages, and it's very difficult to get people to invest in new technology in R&D. But the Japanese are much more enlightened in that area than we seem to be.
But White admits the current radioactive storage requirements may not be the best in the long run. While the salt cakes are a solid, he says microwaves are capable of turning waste into glass and ceramic, which are much more stable. And White says many in the business do not take into account that radioactivity will remain in the earth for thousands of years.
From a term of public acceptance point of view, I think glass-like or ceramic waste forms are the future, as I see it. There are a lot of hurdles, obviously, to getting waste forms into a repository, but a lot of the there are things called intrusion scenarios that people have to look at where, for example, these repositories have to be maintained for tens of thousands of years in some cases. And so you can't take credits for there being a DOE or even a United States of America when you try to dream up scenarios of how people will get into this waste. One of the scenarios involves maybe somebody drilling for water or oil and drilling through a hole in the top of the repository and getting into this waste. And when you have those kinds of scenarios, you have to take credits for the basic waste form integrity and strength that you have. And that's where glass or ceramic type waste forms are far superior to other types.
White is perfecting a process that stores radioactive waste in ceramic form. But he says with the costs of regulatory compliance, some industries are reluctant to do more than is required by law. And at this point, what is required is only a dry salt cake. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our show for this week. Our piece on radioactive waste treatment was written and produced by Karen Kelly. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. This week, ask for the Environment Show number 110. That's 1-800-767-1929. Today, number 110. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.